A great pleasure to be here. In fact, it's my first time on the American continent, so it's even better. So here's the motivation of what I'm doing. So in the last couple of years, Dupuy, Friedel, Levine, Speciale, and Damonino developed tristorial, or rather bispinorial formulation for SU2 Ashteker-Barbero variables. So to each link of the boundary spin network, they assign a tristor which carries information on area, angles, and extrinsic curvature. And this makes them very powerful tools for the semi-classical analysis of loop quantum gravity. However, these are SU2 variables. And this raises the notorious question how these transform under general Lorentz transformations. And so on the boosts, so to say. And the obvious way to answer this question is, of course, to generalize the formalism from SU2 variables up to the true space-time parallel transport, that is to SL to complex variables, to SL2C variables, which are constructed from the intrinsic geometry and the extrinsic curvature tensor, so gamma plus IK, the original choice, of course, of the whole loop program. The next motivation for what I'm doing is the following. So if speaking about twisters, it's an somehow immediate question whether we can relate this program to the one of Penrose. So is there a relation to Penrose's program and of twister theory? And that's an intriguing question simply because Penrose's twister comes with two immediate physical interpretations. So first, it represents, or well, first, it that's now first, it represents a light ray in in space-time incident to a point, so going through a point. And that could allow us maybe possibly to speak more about causality, so about the light construction in loop quantum gravity. Next, it also comes with a notion of curvature. In fact, the curvature of the twister is nothing than the self-dual part of the Weyl tensor. And that object carries all information about gravitational waves. So that would be a very powerful tool, in fact. But in order to use this fancy language and in order to answer these questions, one has first to generalize to SL2C variables, that is to complex variables. And solely this is the purpose of my talk I'm giving here now. So and here's the outline. So first, I do the generalization from starting from the original action we use in loop quantum gravity. So there is the Barbero emulsi parameter, which is kept real, but I'm using complex variables in order to parametrize the phase space. Then I go, which is sometimes called the loop hypothesis, to a reduced phase space of smeared variables and introduce a spinorial decomposition. So this part two is very similar to the talk, so it's very short, but very similar to the talk Mark has yesterday given to us. Then, by the use of complex variables, we have to expect additional conditions, namely reality conditions. And these reality conditions I write in the Spinor language and actually solve them. And this is done by in point four during canonical quantization. And if there is still time, I will answer the question how these can be related to the earlier Spinor papers of Friedel and Speciale. So this one, twisters to twisted geometries. So we start with the first part of the talk, complex Ashteker variables for real-valued Barbero emulsi parameter. So this is nothing but the Horst action, that is the loop quantum gravity action the action we use in loop quantum gravity, that consisting of the Palatini part plus an additional term which leaves the equations of motion unchanged. And in terms of complex variables, it looks like this. So R is the curvature of the SL2C connection, that is just the self-dual part of the curvature tensor, and sigma is the self-dual part of the Blavatsky 2 form. And this is the self-dual action, that is the one that was originally used in loop quantum gravity, but it is multiplied by a complex number. And this complex number is parametrized by the Barbero immersive parameter. And we take the complex conjugate, so we arrive at an action which is a real number, and that's exactly the Horst action. And exactly. So A and B are Spinor indices, which run from 0 to 1. And if we decompose sigma into a basis in Spinor space that are just the Pauli matrices, we see that this is just the self-dual part of the Blavatsky 2 form. So the spatial part plus I, the boost part, so to say. And if we now perform a 3+1 split, we arrive at the symplectic structure, which we can just read off this action. So it tells us that the momentum conjugate to the connection is nothing that the Blavatsky 2 form multiplied by this complex number. But if we use complex variables instead of the real valued SU2 variables, we have to expect additional reality conditions. And by the use of time gauge, that is, we align the one of the tetrod fields to the surface normal of the hypersurface, these reality conditions take a simple form. So if we choose this time gauge, then this tells us that all the components of the Blavatsky 2 form are real. So if these are all real, this translates into a condition on the momentum variable. And the condition on the momentum variable is that this quantity is constrained to vanish. And now the... Yeah, exactly. So beta is written here is just the Horst action. So beta is the immersive parameter, and it's just a real number.
So what you're going to do doesn't extend. There's no analytical continuation to the daily case where beta is going to be I or minus.
No, exactly. So this is just the original action rewritten in the self-dual variables. Which are necessary in order to generalize our formalism to SL2C. But the idea is not to change the action to the self-dual action.
Changing the action, but looking at a complex immediate parameter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is what we are not, what I'm not doing. So now pi is complex. So if we introduce real and imaginary parts of pi, which correspond to boosts and rotations, we find that this reality condition takes the form of the linear simplicity constraint. So we have k plus beta l equals 0. So this somehow relates the covariant formulation of spin form gravity, where the linear simplicity constraint is the key ingredient for the model, to the Hamiltonian formalism. So that's the first part was already is very short. We now go to the phase space for this which are generated by this.
You mentioned something about second class.
So this constraint is of second class. So that means that it is not preserved under the time evolution, and additional secondary constraints are needed. And this secondary constraint tells us that the spatial part of the torsion 2 form vanishes. So the the three-dimensional connection is just the Levi-Civitar connection. That's the secondary constraint associated to this constraint. So CIA. So CIA equals zero. That's the reality condition. And if you preserve that this is preserved in time, so we check if the Poisson bracket of CIA with the Hamiltonian, whether this vanishes, and we find it doesn't vanish, but an additional constraint needs to be imposed. And that's just AIA plus A bar IAA is the Levi-Civitar, two times Levi-Civitar connection corresponding to the tetrod field, which is equivalent to saying that the three that the three-dimensional projection of the torsion two form vanishes. So these are just equivalent. But I don't want to, or in this talk, I don't want to talk much about this, or that's the only thing I talk during this talk about this constraint. But I'm focusing more on the phase space. Yes?
So the original astrograph
The original is would be beta equals I.
But you said beta is
the
real.
Yes, exactly. So I'm using beta is here a real parameter. So the action is just real, but I decompose this action in terms of complex variables, which I can always do, of course. Ah, okay. So this action, so this integral is a complex number.
Right.
And this is also a complex number, but beta is real. And together with, so this complex conjugate is the complex conjugate of this whole term.
So what if you drop the complex conjugate term?
Well, then I get, then I can also drop this one. Because
yes.
That's
the original
yes.
That we use for the astrograph.
Yes, but I'm not using that. Now we construct holonomies and fluxes. That's somehow the loop hypothesis that we should work with, not with a continuum phase space, but with a truncated phase space of a finite number of degrees of freedom. So the connection is smeared over links, whereas the giving the parallel propagator, whereas the momentum variable is smeared over phases dual to the links. And in order to arrive at the covariant smearing, one has to introduce holonomies into the definition of the smearing of the momentum variable, which is exactly what also Mark did in his last talk. So we arrive just at the usual holonomy flux algebra, but now for SL2C.
This is the same condition as the one you would find in the self-dual formulation.
Yes, of course. So
but now you say that you use real beta, so A is real.
No, A. So A during this talk, A means always A is gamma plus I K. So I never use.
No, you don't use A as gamma plus beta K.
No.
Why? Okay.
So then
I'm confused. So you don't use the real unity parameter then?
Well, it's just
everywhere you use the self-dual connection.
So
all that you did is you multiplied the action that used to be used by this 1 plus I beta factor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. So I arrive at an overall, I have the very same action as originally used, so I have the Holst action for real beta, which
you express in terms of the cellular
connection. Yeah, exactly.
So A is the cellular connection,
A
and
is
I is the cellular part.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they have the same reality.
Yeah, they have the same reality.
So this is the phase space, which is for this the phase space of smeared variables for these complex variables, and now we go to our main task, namely to decompose this phase space in terms of spinors, because we want to because that's the task I've asked myself, to generalize this twister formulation of loop quantum gravity to the true space-time connection. So, but in order to do this, we have to first understand what is a twister. So, here it's nothing than a bispinor, one part of which lives in C2 and the other one in its complex conjugate dual vector space. And on this bispinor, the SL2C group acts in the natural way, that is just by matrix multiplication. So think of omega just as omega 0, omega 1, and then SL2C acts just by group multiplication onto these variables. And for these spinors, we can introduce a natural symplectic structure, which tells us nothing that pi is the momentum conjugate of omega. And by this choice, we immediately arrive at an SL2C invariant symplectic structure, simply because here is a delta function which is invariant under.
Sorry, but you have pi and pi bar, so what's the difference between pi and pi bar a dot and pi a dot?
Pi bar is the. Pi bar is
and the dual spinor.
Yes, and pi bar is the complex conjugate of pi.
So spinor is omega and pi bar.
And now having omega is in C2, pi bar is a complex conjugate spinor. Now that we have these variables, we can parametrize the original phase space in terms of these spinors. And that's done in the next slide, which is the most important slide of the whole talk. So if you understand that one, you understand everything. So here we have the original variables. So this is a link, and along the link, we smear the self-dual connection, obtaining an SL2C element. The flux is smeared over the phase dual to the link and parallelly transported to the initial point. And we can, of course, also parallelly transport the flux to the final point, obtaining pi to the f minus 1. And now we decompose these variables in terms of spinorial fields. And that's done in the following way. So pi AB is an SL2C element. That means it is traceless. So pi AA is 0. But now we can raise one of these indices by the epsilon tensor, so which is invariant under SL2C. So we can construct this object. Pi AC. Where epsilon is the invariant tensor. So this is, and this one is invariant under SL2C, so it is used to raise and lower indices on spinorial indices. And now the tracelessness of this object translates into the symmetry of AB. So this is equivalent to pi AB equals pi BA. But now, given an object which possesses this symmetry, we can always decompose it in terms of spinors. And the same is true, of course, for the final point. And this decomposition is not unique, so we can always exchange the order of these spinors or rescale them. But we can always choose the spinors, say, at the final point, such that the holonomy maps omega to omega tilde and pi to pi tilde. So we have the following image. So we have at the initial point a pair of spinors that parameterize the SL to C element, and on the final point where there is the SL to C element parallelly transported to the endpoint, we can make the same decomposition. And now we can choose always reordering or rescaling of omega and pi tilde, such that the holonomy maps omega to omega tilde and pi to pi tilde.
Just a query, how do you know that you can always make that choice? Why can you always make that choice?
That I'm saying now. So why I can do this always?
Yeah.
So first we have this invariance under these rescalings. But holonomy parallel transports this object to that one. So if we perform here the parallel transport, we get, so that's a bit technical, but so at the initial point you have pi AB. Plus omega b pi a. And if we now perform the parallel transport, we get pi tilde a b is minus 1/4 the parallel transport of these objects. So some h times omega a h times pi b plus etc. But for this object, we have chosen a parametrization Now, this decomposition is unique only up to rescaling. So we can always, these two spinors must be equivalent up to rescaling or reordering. That is, we can always find a rescaling such that they are the same. So that's. And here's a plus. Because we have changed the orientation of F. And now that we have this parametrization, we can just reverse the logic. So we can start with a pair of twisters, so omega and omega pi, omega tilde pi tilde, and parametrize all both holonomy and flux in terms of these variables. But in order to achieve this parametrization to work, we need two requirements, both of which have a clean physical interpretation. So the first one is that these two spinors must be linearly independent, which means that pi a omega a is non-vanishing. But pi a omega a is nothing than the Lorentzian norm of the momentum variable. So if pi a omega a is not allowed to vanish, the norm of this flux is not allowed to vanish. So the surface F is not allowed to be a null surface. So it can only be space or time-like. But that is not so harmful, because in loop quantum gravity, we are mostly studying either space or time-like surfaces anyhow. The next requirement is that H is a proper SL2C element. So that means that this transformation H preserves the norm pi a omega a. So pi a omega a must be the same at the initial point and the final point. So what have we achieved so far? So far, we have not achieved so much. We have just parametrized both holonomies and fluxes in terms of spinorial variables. And here I've given you explicitly the formulas which parametrize holonomy and flux in terms of these spinors. So there are two spinors for each link, one pair pi omega for the initial point, and one pair pi omega tilde for the final point. And the flux decomposes according to this, whereas the holonomy tells us that pi is mapped under the holonomy to pi tilde and omega to omega tilde. And this equation already uniquely fixes the holonomy in terms of pi and omega, provided this requirement is fulfilled. And you see, if this is not fulfilled, this denominator would be zero, and this decomposition wouldn't work anymore. And there's also this constraint, which tells us that pi a omega a at the initial point must be the same as pi a omega tilde, which is nothing but the generalization of the area matching constraint of the earlier Twister papers, SU2 Twister papers to SL2C. And this parametrization is also not unique. We still have some residual symmetries, namely just scaling transformations. So we can, for instance, we can multiply this by some e to the z and omega by e to the minus z, and this parametrization is left invariant. And the same is true for H, for the holonomy.
So you earlier introduced a symplectic structure on the omegas and the pis, Poisson brackets for the omegas and the pis. Do they imply the Poisson brackets for the pis and the h's?
Yeah, that's exactly the second point. What about what you're asking now? So what is, up to now I've just given a parametrization, which is fine, but the important point is whether also the symplectic structure is recovered from this spinorial parametrization. And if we introduce these Poisson brackets, we get that the original Poisson brackets for pi and h are perfectly recovered. In fact, these two equations can be proven. That's just a one-line proof. The only difficulty is to prove that also the matrix elements of holonomies Poisson commute among themselves. And in general, they do, in fact, not, but only on the constraint hypersurface, the matrix elements of holonomies commute. But that's perfectly fine, because we start with a big phase space of, so this is the space of.
What's the CC? You mean the norm pi omega?
Yeah, exactly. So we have pi omega, pi tilde, omega tilde. So a huge phase space, but only on a constraint hypersurface. So C equals zero, where C is pi a omega a minus pi tilde a omega tilde a, we have a correspondence between points here and points in the original phase space. So only on this constrained hypersurface, there is the we recover elements of the phase space of holonomies and fluxes. And only on this hypersurface, the Poisson brackets match. So that's perfectly fine, of course.
Off that hypersurface, is the Poisson bracket something interesting?
Sorry?
Is the Poisson bracket off C equals zero, is the Poisson bracket something interesting?
Well, it just looks a mess, but...
Okay, so it's H2.
So they do not commute off shell.
But it's not an interesting algebra.
No, well, I haven't found something interesting there, but maybe I should have looked.
Well, it's suggestive that maybe, you know, there's this non-commutative connection that people talk about when they
yeah, it in fact would imply.
So, but nobody has ever found a way to make it, you know, discrete or polarized.
So in the
spin networks, which exactly allow the non-area matching condition.
Yeah.
There's this, you know, intermediate connection with Alexandrov.
Yeah. So one could ask what happens outside of this constraint. Mm-hmm. And if you look here, then that tells us that H is not a... So if this is not conserved, these two norms, then that tells us that we are not dealing with SL2C transformations, but with a larger group. And now knowing this, we can perform a symplectic reduction with respect to this constraint. So I've said on this constraint hypersurface, so points on this constraint hypersurface correspond to points in the original phase space. But in fact, there's a residual gauge symmetry. So there are some orbits, and each point of on these orbits correspond to a point in the original phase space. So by original phase space, I mean the phase space of holonomies and fluxes. And these orbits, these gauge orbits, are in fact precisely these scaling transformations I've talked earlier. And they are generated by the constraint C. And that means, when speaking about symplectic reduction, then we mean that we solve the constraint, and on the constraint hypersurface, we remove the additional gauge degree of freedom this constraint generates. And if we... So we can make a little calculation. That's this line essentially. So the original phase space has 2 times. So the phase space of our twistorial phase space. So this whole object has 2 times 2 times 2 complex degrees of freedom. So there are 2 twisters for both the initial and the final. So there are 2 twisters, one to the initial point, one to the final point. Each twister contains 2 spinors, and each spino has 2 components. So this has 8 complex degrees of freedom. And if we solve the constraint C equals 0 and do a symplectic reduction, that removes us 2 degrees of freedom, 2 complex degrees of freedom, because we go to the constraint hypersurface, so that removes 1, and the equivalence class of gauge orbits removes another degree of freedom. So we have 2 times 2, so that's 8, that's 6, and that's exactly the number of degrees of freedom the phase space of holonomy and fluxes on a single link has. Because that's just T star of, on a single link, that's just T star of SL2C. So SL2C as a group has 3 complex degrees of freedom, so 3 boosts and 3 rotations. And because it's a phase space, it has 3 times 2 complex degrees of freedom. freedom. So that's okay. So far so good. And now, we have now seen this parameterization in terms of twisters, and we also saw that the phase space that the original phase space of smeared variables can be recovered equally well. And now I want to show you that this is also useful by solving the reality conditions of the theory. So now we come to an application showing that this is a useful formalism. So when I speak about reality conditions in this talk, I only mean the reality conditions on the momentum variable, not this one, but just that one. So in the beginning of the talk, I showed you that the reality conditions are nothing than the simplicity constraints. So there are these two formulations of loop quantum gravity. On the one side, there is the canonical formulation, the covariant formulation of spin from gravity, and on the other side, there's the Hamiltonian formulation. And the Hamiltonian formulation in these complex variables comes with some reality condition, and the covariant theory comes with simplicity constraints, and they are actually just the same as I showed you. So the origin of the reality conditions we understand now. The origin of the linear simplicity constraints is something different. It's something different in this formulation. So they guarantee, in fact, the simplicity of the Blebanski 2 form around the 4 simplex, where simplicity means simply the existence of a tetrod field such that sigma is EVHE. And in the I want to show you now that the Spinor formulation allows for clean handling of these constraints. And in order to do so, I have first to rewrite this equation in terms of Spinors, which I've done here. And now I insert the decomposition of the, so this is an equation on the flux, which appears here. And if I insert the decomposition of the flux variables into this equation, if I insert this decomposition into the reality condition, I come to this equation.
Sorry, can you rewind a bit? Where does this end? Where does this end? What's coming, what's going on there?
Yes. So the simplicity constraint, so the linear simplicity constraint, that is a condition on the Blebanski 2 form. It tells us that if we smear this constraint over a phase, and
did you show that the reality conditions are the linear simplicity constraint?
Yes. So.
Where is beta then?
So what do you want to show me?
I don't know.
That
I mean, you talked earlier about the reality condition.
Yes. So
did you talk about the linear simplicity constraint?
Okay. Thank you. Whoever did that.
Yeah, you should always start by the last layer in black.
The linear simplicity constraints tell us So this is now in the covariant formulation, that if we take if we smear the Blavatsky 2 form.
Which one, the subdual one?
No, that's just the so this quantity. So if we smear this over a face and contract it with the normal, that is the normal to the Cauchy hypersurface, then we get zero. Now, if we want to write this equation in terms of spinors, we have to first remember the correspondence between space-time vectors and spinors. So this is found by Penrose, essentially, who tells us that any space-time vector corresponds to a Hermitian matrix. And how is this correspondence performed? Well, there are these soldering forms, which are nothing but the Pauli spin matrices. So if we contract this Pauli spin matrices with these space-time vectors, we get a Hermitian matrix. And that's the correspondence between space-time, between vectors in space-time and spinors. So any vector in space-time corresponds to a Hermitian matrix on to a Hermitian matrix, or an anti-Hermitian matrix if you choose a different sign convention of the metric. So so now we have to insert so this equation translates into this equation. So any space-time vector, any space-time index is simply replaced by an by a pair of index, one in the fundamental representation and one in the complex conjugate representation. And now the sigma, this so sigma AB is anti-symmetric. This translates into conditions on A and A bar, namely that it can be written like this: sigma so the Blavatsky 2 form is anti-symmetric in its space-time indices, and the anti-symmetricity in the space-time indices translates into a condition of these indices. And this condition guarantees that we that one can write sigma AB always like this, where sigma AB, this is now the self-dual part of sigma alpha beta. And that's the anti-self-dual part. And explicitly, so in terms of So in other words, this equation is the same as the original one, and it's equivalent to the reality conditions we have found in the very beginning of the talk. And into this, I've now inserted the spinorial decomposition, which I've done here. So this is So here is the flux multiplied by this complex number, and we take the complex conjugate. Now these are three equations because most easily seen here. So these are four, this is a space-time index, so this runs from 0 to 1, but this is already 0. So this can only be this cannot be four independent. So alpha runs from 0 to 1. These are not four equations, but only three. So this one has two free Spino indices. So if we want to impose this constraint, we could say, well, we just impose it for all possible free combinations of these indices. But now that we have Spinos at our disposal, we can equally well construct a complete basis and construct these free indices with all possible combinations of basis vectors and impose instead the resulting components. So if we perform these contractions, we get the following two constraints. And now one could say, wait a second, we have this basis, but you could choose another one. And of course, we one just gets the one always gets the same constraints. So how many equations are these? Well, here's a complex conjugate. So this is just a real number. So that's one equation. And next, F2 is just a complex number. So these are three real equations. And so from this perspective, that's perfectly fine. But if we are interested to impose these constraints in quantum theory, we have to look at the corresponding constraint algebra. And well, that looks a bit complicated. But the only thing one has to keep in mind is that one of these constraints is a first-class constraint, whereas the second one is of second class. So all Poisson brackets of F1 with the other two constraints again give a constraint. So F1 is of first class. So first class, and that one is of second class. But we want to impose them in quantum theory, so we have to think about how to do this, because second-class constraints cannot easily be quantized. And so...
Unless beta is I.
Sorry?
Unless beta is I.
Unless...
there's some value of beta for which F2 is no longer
small. Yeah, so in the case of...
The 19C is the same one as F2. As F1, up to some beta risk.
Yeah, but...
Again, what F1 is, the previous slide?
F1 is here.
Yeah.
So, it's that one.
Maybe beta equals zero.
Because if beta is I, you get an issue in the 19B.
Yeah, but I have... Well, I've chosen from the very beginning beta to be real. I mean, from the perspective of this self-dual action, it makes no sense to ask what happens if beta is real, because so the action looks like this: S Holst is the self-dual action multiplied with some complex number plus complex conjugate.
Sorry, if beta is infinite, then it's first class. Right? Because F1...
No. F1 is always first class simply because...
No, but if beta is infinite, the last equation becomes proportional to F1.
Ah, okay. If Well, if no, if beta. Well, if beta is infinite, this is just.
Well, you multiply by beta, it doesn't change the thing. So the constant
yes.
is omega minus omega. Right. It becomes the right hand side of 90C. It converged to the right hand side of 90C.
No, but here is then. Yeah, you're right. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, you can talk about beta F1.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, in order to solve this constraint, yeah, beta to infinity would correspond to that the Hoyle's term is vanishing. So the original, just the Einstein-Palatini.
Yeah, which is the case which is always special, which was the Barrett-Crane case. Or, you know, it's always a case which.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah. So. So in now we have this. So F one is of first class because it will produce as a constraint, but F two is not. So in order to solve this second class constraint in quantum theoretically, it is useful to define the master constraint, which is just the square modulus of F two, and the vanishing of F two is of course. Of M, the master constraint, is of course trivially equivalent to the vanishing of F2, which is of second class. Moreover, the Poisson bracket of F1 with M is identically zero. So in Tiemann's approach, one can here in general have something which is not, which is only constrained to vanish on shell. But here it's identically zero, which makes the quantization easy.
Excuse me, I'm confused about it. F2 is complex.
Yes.
And M is real.
And M is real.
So how can you replace two constraints, two real constraints, by one real constraint?
So it is like saying.
Okay.
So if you introduce A X plus IP, so creation and annihilation operators, you can.
No, I mean I understand the math. Anyway, go ahead. I'll ask my question later.
Okay. Yeah, so we perform canonical quantization, and in this, in terms of these Spinor variables, that can be done quite easily just by replacing the momentum by a partial derivative. And now we look at these constraints and canonical quantize. Well, this expression. For this expression, we have to choose an ordering, simply because omega and pi do not commute. So we say, well, the quantization of this object is the quantization one half. So the quantization of omega times pi is one half omega quantization omega times quantization pi plus the reversed order. So that's a normal ordering. And then we get to the following equation. So and for F2, we do not need an ordering simply because these two operators commute. But again, for the master constraint, we need an ordering because F2 doesn't commute with F2 dagger in quantum theory. So choosing an ordering, we get to the following constraints. So L and K are the generators of boosts and rotations. So L squared minus K squared is one of the Casimirs of SL2C, and L squared is just the squared angular momentum. And so looking at this equation, we can observe these operators, omega A, D over D, omega A. And these are homogeneity operators. That is, the eigenfunctions of these operators are just homogeneous functions of omega. And therefore, one may say, well, let's quantize them on homogeneous functions. And why should we do this, in fact? Well, because on these functions, which are homogeneous, because only on these homogeneous functions, the SL2C group, which is the Lorentz group, acts unitarily. And in quantum theory, we are, of course, only interested in unitary representations of the group, not in any other representations. So these are these homogeneity operators. And on these homogeneous functions, they are diagonal. And the homogeneity weight is parameterized by two numbers, J0, which is a spin, and rho, which is a continuous parameter. And for these functions, there exists an invariant inner product, which means, of course, that SL2C acts unitary on them. And the basis vectors are labeled, and one can find a canonical basis which is labeled by the spin quantum numbers of the SU2 subgroup of SL2C.
So the master constraint you had was invariant under SL2, or?
So the master constraint is constructed from this F2. And here appears N, which is the surface normal. So it can only be, constraint is basically the squared modulus of this constraint. But since there is the surface normal appearing, this constraint can only be invariant under the transformations which leave this surface normal invariant, and this is only the SU2 subgroup. And it can, in fact, already be seen here because this is a Casimir, so it's invariant. Here we have invariant contractions, so it is also invariant. But here is just the squared angular momentum, and that's not the Lorentz scalar. So the answer to your question is no, the master constraint is not SL2C gauging. And now we can solve these two equations, which are equivalent to the reality conditions on these homogeneous functions. And since we have chosen these homogeneous functions, both constraints are just diagonal on them. In fact, the first constraint tells us that the continuous label in the homogeneity weight is related to the discrete label J0 by the Barbero immersive parameter, whereas the master constraint tells us that all spins are in the lowest possible weight. So this these homogeneous functions, so rho and J labels the irreducible unitary representation of SL2C, and the labels JM are the bases inside this representation space. So they label the bases. And now the first constraint, which as you notice, is SL2C invariant, tells us that this label is related to that one by the immersive parameter, so beta J0. And the second constraint, which is the master constraint, tells us that these two J two spins are related to one another. So it tells us that all spins are in the lowest possible weight. So we have beta j, j. And we call these states jm. And that's essentially the Dupuy-Levine map, which sends SU2 irreducible representations in SL2C irreducible representations. And why is this map important? Simply because it is key for the construction of the EPIL spin form model. So if you have this, if you have this map sending SU2 representations into SL2C representations, you have more or less the spin form model. And this map doesn't just fall from the sky. It is, of course, as I've shown you, the solution of the reality conditions. And since this from these states, we can now reconstruct our Hilbert space. So we can these are states which just live at one. These states come from a quantization of this variable. So they live just on one half of these link, so to say. So if we want to construct a full state, we have to glue things together. So at first along one link, and then we also have to glue all links meeting at the node together. And what we then arrive at are precisely SU2 spin network states. So when one can now say, well, now you have done all these complicated things, and in the end, you just arrive at everything, at something which has been constructed already long ago. So what is the purpose of this, what you are doing? Well, the difference or the purpose is that the reduction from SL2C, that is from the Lorentz group, down to the Ashtekar variables, that is to SU2, is not in the configuration variable, but in the states. So in the original formalism, one starts from SL2C, and by imposing the constraints, one arrives at the SU2 variables. But here, we have done the opposite. The configuration variable is, in this language, just this spin or omega in C2. And it transforms just perfectly under SL2C and doesn't know anything about SU2. But we have still a reduction from SL2C to SU2. But now it's in the other side somehow. It's not here in the variables we use to quantize, but instead in the states. And that makes it, I think, useful. So now I can either skip this and we discuss something, or I go to this other.
Can you say what it is?
Or it depends on. We can also maybe take a few minutes for questions or about what you said now. And if there's no, if you don't have questions, you can say a few words about the piece.
I mean, I've inserted this chapter in the case I'm too slow or too. I don't talk enough. It's
so first you have questions.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a kind of obvious
question. So I don't have a discussion yet.
The answer will be no, but to my question. twisters originally came about as a representation of the conformal group of SO42 or SU22.
Yes.
If you've gotten as far as there are role for extending to some role, the conformal group would then mix the holonomies and the fluxes somehow. Is there a role for the conformal group?
Well, here there are also the scaling transformation of the spinors, which one could say are something like conformal transformations, but they leave in fact everything invariant. Therefore, they are gauge symmetries. So,
right, so that's not. The...
So that's not. I think are not those conformal transformations you were looking for. But there's also another difference to the original work of Penrose, because his kind of obvious thing, his twisters are solutions to a kind to the twister equation. So they are somehow fields on space-time. And here they are assigned to a link, to something non-local. So that's something different.
It's something maybe to play with. The reality condition simplified in terms of the omegas and pi's? What about the other constraints, the Gauss law, the Hamiltonian energy homomorphism?
The Gauss law, I mean, there's no Gauss law in loop quantum gravity. There's no problem with the Gauss law in loop quantum gravity. We can easily solve it. And in terms of these spinor variables, we learn, I think, nothing new about the Gauss law. But what I think, what is very interesting to look at in this formalism are the Bianchi identities, in fact. So I've played a bit with this, namely those equations. So this is essentially the Gauss law. Sigma is the Blebanski 2 form, so d wedge sigma equals 0. So if we apply, if we calculate d squared sigma, this is f wedge sigma equals 0. And that's one of the Bianchi identities. Mm-hmm. And if you look at these, they simplify in terms of in terms of these variables. I've just done the calculations. So I've not inserted this to this talk. So I think it is a very powerful tool to study geometry, this parametrization. So in fact, one can that's some kind of commutator, so that has still two free indices. And the other that's one Bianchi identity. And then another one, what one can study in this formalism is,
So what's the relation to the twisted geometry, briefly?
Okay. The relation is basically this. On the level of these, so if we look at these constraints, we can actually solve them classically, we can immediately solve them, and the solutions are just parametrized by one number. So if we
the delta AA bar is sitting in place for the norm.
Yeah, it's a, yeah. So delta.
Yeah, it's an AA bar. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the, yeah, delta is an AA bar, and so the this so these two equations, if we solve them, the solution tells us that so the solutions are just parameterized by one real number, j, and they tell us that pi is essentially proportional to this omega. And if we now define from these SL2 spinors the following two quantities, where xi is the logarithm of the norm with respect to this delta over, so of omega over omega tilde, and j is just the j is this quantity. So if we define these SU2 spinors now, then we find that they are canonically conjugate to each other. So if we compute the Poisson brackets on the big phase space for these SU2 twin spinors, we get these Poisson brackets, which now tell us the set bar is the momentum conjugate to Z. But unlike the original twisters, these are now original spinors, these are now SU2 spinors. So what do I mean by this? Well, simply that the original spinors transformed covariantly under the full Lorentz group, so under SL2C. But now these spinors transform only under SU2, which comes basically from the fact that we have divided here by these norms, and these norms are not preserved by SL2C, but only by SU2. So we get to this symplectic structure, which is exactly the symplectic structure of the original SU2 spinor papers. But it is more than that, because if we look at the parallel transport, then we see that the spinor set tilde, which lives at the final point, is related to the spinor set at the initial point by the Ashteker-Barbero connection. So the original spinors, pi and omega, were transformed parallelly by the full space-time connection. But if we solve these constraints, these two, then we find that the reduced spinors are parallelly transported by the reduced connection, that is the Ashteker-Barbero connection.
I'm a bit surprised about this equation, because it seems to me you solve the constraints only at the endpoints of the links. So you have somehow the Ashteker-Barbero connection, but only on the link, not on the source and targets.
That's in fact exactly this. So that tells us that this equation is only true for up to first order, but that's not so surprising, because we started from smeared phase spaces and then made a reduction by solving the reality conditions, and we cannot really expect that performing a reduction commutes with a smearing of the phase space variables. So that's I think a very nice result somehow, because it relates everything what I've did somehow to what already existed. So we can really claim that this is a generalization of the original formalism, simply because by doing the reduction, we get to the original variables.
Do you have the geometric interpretation?
And I have a geometric interpretation. So J, yeah. So what is the geometric interpretation? Well, the geometric interpretation we can just take from the earlier results, which tell us that J is the area of the link, and xi is the norm of the extrinsic curvature. And that one recovers, so that this is related to that by the Ashtekar connection comes basically from this e to the I beta psi, because in the Ashtekar connection with mu, so this I beta psi is essentially this thing here. So I repeat what I've said, if there is still time. So in the very beginning, I have introduced, I have taken the original loop quantum gravity action, that is the one for real valued Barbero immersive parameter, and parameterized everything in terms of SL2C variables, that is complex variables. And then we found additional reality conditions, because dealing with complex variables, we need some additional constraints removing unphysical degrees of freedom. And these additional constraints match the reality conditions of spinform gravity. Then we studied the phase space of holonomy and fluxes. And we found that we can parameterize it in terms of spinors. But not only we can parameterize them, we can also recover all the symplectric structure from this spinorial decomposition. And this decomposition comes, however, with two requirements. First, that this surface is not a null surface. And the next requirement was the constraint C equals zero, which, as we saw, generates gauge transformations on the twistorial phase space. And then we looked onto the reality conditions. In fact, they reduced to two constraints, F1 equals zero and F2 equals zero. And in quantum theory, we solved them by the Tiemann's master constraint approach. And the solution space picked big states, JM, which correspond to SU2 representations. What is very nice, and that may answer your question, Jörg, please. We had F2 equals zero, F2 bar equals zero. And this is a second class constraint. And we imposed it by saying this is equivalent of saying this is zero. And in quantum theory, we found states that actually solve this equation. But now one could ask, well, what happens if I go with, what happens if I act with the quantization of F2 and F2 bar on these states? And what happens is that F2 JM annihilates all states in the solution space, but the quantization of F2 bar, that is F2 dagger, is not zero. So that's exactly the same as always happens if we quantize second class constraints, that only half of the constraints are imposed strongly, and the other ones, and the adjoint sends the solution space to its orthogonal complement. And then as a separate part in my talk, in the very last part, I briefly mentioned the reduction, the classical reduction from SL2C down to SU2. And what I get is that the solution space precisely corresponds to the construction of SU2 spinors for loop quantum gravity, which was earlier done by by you and Speziale. Well, this I may skip, and we come to the questions. Yeah.